memory serves me correctly, no baseball players are in this room, right? This class?
Okay, cool. Just mentally checking. So we got lots to do, little time to do it. We got to finish up our information. As I said last week, and I'll mention it again when we get to the end of the class, I'm going to give you your second exam. I'll open it up on Thursday afternoon, and I'll leave it open until Sunday. At some point, sit down, take it, and then I will count that towards your midterm. Because technically, I'm supposed to submit my grades on Friday, but I'm not going to force you to take an exam when I know some of you are probably going to be on the road going home. So at least by allowing you to get till Sunday, if you need time, you know, if you're flying or driving, whatever, you can be grounded, and I'm sure by that point, you'll be settled down enough to give me an hour. And it is not cumulative, so it's not like a midterm. It's only going to be on the information that we started upon completion of the first exam. So we start off with China. So the stuff we covered with China, the stuff we covered for Japan, the Ottoman Empire, and of course today we're on the Safavids, and then we'll conclude with the Mughals, which we'll either start today or maybe we'll start on Thursday. We'll see how far we get. Actually, no, we're going to start the Mughals today. What am I talking about? Because I don't have much for the Safavids. All right. So as we recognize, the Safavids were theocracy. They were a society where they believed God ruled over them. Although they would end up having earthly rulers who ruled in the name of Allah. And that would begin when one of the members of the Brotherhood, the Safavid Brotherhood, would emerge as a grand conqueror and would subjugate that region in and around today, generally speaking, that we call Iran. And the empire creator was Ismail. I really don't have much to talk about. Ismail's power essentially was established upon the fact that, as I said, the Brotherhood had become militarily aggressive. So the members of the Brotherhood served as like the commanders. They were the nobility, and they utilized religious warfare, jihad, and would rain holy terror down upon all those who attempted to resist. By 1510, he managed to conquer all of Islam, and one of the first acts that he did upon taking control was declaring that the Shiite form of Islam would be the religion of the state. Now, the interesting thing was is at the time, Shiism was completely foreign to the majority of people who lived in Persia. There were a high Muslim population, but most of them were Sunni, meaning they believed that the leader of their faith could be freely elected. But when Ismail essentially outlawed Sunni Islam, that would in the end cause many people to either convert or flee. Now, as far as conversion, it was done by force. People were not given a choice. Soldiers literally would show up to your house and you'd have to pledge an oath. If you tried refusing, I know sometimes when I ask students questions, you know, they think, oh, if I was in that place, you know, I would be so tough. Yeah, no, you wouldn't. These individuals are forced to change their religion, literally under direct threat. And if they refused, they were killed. There was no questions. They weren't asked nicely. Convert or die. Which the majority who remained did. Because they didn't really have a choice. But to maintain this control, one of the things that Ismail and his successors would do is they would open up their kingdom to Shiite scholars from all over the Islamic world. And that's one of the reasons why today, geographically speaking, almost all of the Muslims that are in the Middle East are Sunni Muslims. Because during this time period, all the Shiites left. They went to Iran or the Safavid Empire at the time. Those who were scholars, known as satyrs, they were actually paid very well. But their job was to coordinate this indoctrination. And essentially they would serve as government officials and they would do whatever the Shah, the leader, Shah wanted. Now, one of the strongest details, I guess you could say, because like I said, I don't really have much to say about them. One of the primary features of this empire was the fact that religion, there was no separation of church and state. Religion would be the tool that the state used to keep everybody in line. So, for instance, the Safavids would use taxes to support the religion. So they would declare, when you pay your taxes to the state, a good chunk of it would go to, say, building shrines or religious schools or temples and so forth. All about having places of worship. Because the Safavids realized if you can control the mind of the people through their faith, they will be obedient. They will not resist. But there also was trickle-down economics. Those people who were skilled, instead of making art, they made religious art. And if they did so well, they were fabulously wealthy. The government would also use land grants to ensure that there was no resistance. So if there was a noble who questioned religion, then we'll give him a huge tract of land. And then he'll be loyal. By the way, this is also one of the reasons why Iran today is such a strong religious state. Because it all dates back to this time period. You know, why do the typical Iranian people submit to the abuse of the Ayatollahs? Well, again, it all goes back to here. Their ancestors, hundreds of years ago, were brought in line, and they always remained in line. Well, besides religion, I got a couple other points just to make in terms of unique things that are touched upon in the book. In order to achieve its results during the Safavid period, they had a very strong, effective government that was centralized. So they didn't use the degree of like regulation that the Ottomans did. But law and order was maintained through direct violence. Again, you obey or you die. If you impose that type of system, again, upon people, they are going to obey. Because no one in their right mind wants to die. They also got lucky. One of the reasons why this empire was able to last for 250 years was because of location, location, location. The Safavid Empire sat on one of those key locations in the Asian trade network. Plus, the land route, the Silk Road, would actually come through their empire as well. So, not only did they have Hormuz here as a major port, which the vessels traveling the Asian trade network stopped at, they were also bringing in goods by land. So, just an ideal situation that allowed tremendous amount of money to boom. So, like Constantinople, the bazaars, the marketplaces of this empire were very, very, very rich and wealthy. And the Safavids took this wealth and poured it into their culture. During this 250-year period, culture, granted it was religious in nature, boomed. The leaders, the nobles, paid skilled artisans to produce works of art. Painting, sculpture, metalwork, carpentry. Granted, it usually depicted religious ideas, but the skills of these individuals were beyond reproach. And ironically, some of the Safavids themselves considered themselves to be artists. Ismail was regarded as one of the leading poets of this period. Shahs constantly used their own money to open up royal workshops. So they were taught, they wanted artistic expression. And even though Iran has ruled the place with the Ayatollahs since the 1970s, their ancient capital of Isfahan, still today, well, granted this picture was in the 60s, but still today is regarded as a very beautiful, clean city. But during its height, it was one of the most beautiful cities on earth at the time. Built by Shah Abbas I, Isfahan would come to exude beauty. They had parks. They had libraries and mosques. There are stories of Dutch and English merchants that brought into the city and literally used phrases like, this is one of the most beautiful sights I've seen. It's proof that God exists. Ironically, Isfahan, this Persian, for half the world. Because at the height, the Safavids believed, you can see the beauty and splendor of half the world just by coming into their city. And at its height, it had a population that exceeded 1 million people. In the 1600s, there weren't many places on earth that had 1 million people living in an urban setting. But they also, according to European visitors, they had 163 mosques, they had 48 religious schools, over 2,000 individual shops, and 263 public baths. Clean, beautiful, opulent. Unlike, you could compare London in 1600. You all have the ability to read English. You can find contemporary stories describing London as basically part of my language, but a shithole. It was dirty. It was disgusting. They didn't have sewage. You know, you do your duty in your little bedpan. You just throw it out in the window. Rat-infested, diseased, fires were common. And you juxtapose London to this place, and there's no comparison. So yes, religion was important, but they also lived a luxurious lifestyle. Questions? Great. Unfortunately, that's about it, because the decline of the Safavids was as quick to arise as their emergence to power. They took control in 1510, but the end of their rule came in 1726. A very short-lived empire. But the reasons for their decline were similar to the Ottoman decline. The only difference, it took 250 years for the Ottomans to implode, whereas it really only took a generation for the Safavids to implode. But the reasons are also similar to the dynastic circle. government officials, teachers, military officers, they became complacent. Government officials, corrupt. Again, why do you think our country is so screwed up? Our country isn't screwed up because of the Constitution. It's not screwed up because of we the people. Our country is screwed up because of the government that we have and the people that work all the government jobs. If we fall apart, historians are going to look back and say, can't believe the American people allowed this to happen to them in the freest place on earth. Well, the same comparison. Because in this situation, however, the people were so used to being obedient, they didn't question, they didn't challenge. They simply submitted. And in the end, they ate themselves from inside out.
But there also was a little different factor. A little different factor.
Unlike in the Ottoman Empire, where the sultans would eventually put the ulamas in their place, those religious scholars, in the Safavid Empire, because it was a theocracy, the religious wise men, the ulamas, their power soon would rise above the Shah himself. And in the end, the ulama would have the power to remove shahs. And it would be the ayatollahs, who are the descendants of the ulama, that still control Iran today.
How did they get away with removing leaders? Well, the ulama developed a theory based on the mujahideen.
The mujahideen is one who is deeply learned in Islamic law. And because one is learned, that gives them the right to rule. Well, here's the thing. If a secular leader, the Shah, was ever to do anything that the priest did not like, the priest could basically contain or contend that he's stupid, that he does not know Islam. And that's all it would take. That was enough of a justification. And they could remove the king. So in that scenario, it's no wonder why the Shahs would eventually be deposed. Because their power rested upon the religious approval of the priests.
Plus, on top of that, as the Shah is losing power, the priests are rising, at the same time, the Europeans began trying to penetrate. Like they were doing all around the Asian trade network. Like we talked about for the first exam. They were coming in. They were using naval superiority. They were taking over shipping lanes. And they would force themselves into the countries. Unfavorable terms. And just like everywhere else on earth, no one could stop the Europeans at this time. So how did they die? Well, they died like all other empires do. Rebellions would break out when the central government couldn't control everything. Territory by territory declared their independence and broke away. And there was nothing that the central state could do. Of course, if you lose provinces, you lose tax money. You lose tax money, you can't maintain the economy. On top of that, not only were the Europeans penetrating from the south through the Asiatic trade routes, not only were provinces eternally breaking away, but the Ottomans were invading from the west.
And the Russians were invading from the north. Similarly, taking chunks, like carving up flesh. Questions? Well, the end came in 1726, to be exact. The Safavids would lose power when a tribe, an outsider tribe, the Afshars, would rise up and seek to overthrow the Safavids. The Afshars were from modern Afghanistan. They drove into Persia and would begin seizing the key cities. Their leader was Nadir. Nadir, in many ways, was similar to Hong Wu, the founder of the Ming. He was a former slave who, once freed, proved himself to be a military genius. Rise through the ranks, eventually taking control of the army. It was he who marched into Isfahan. It was he who entered the palace of the last Safavid Shah. It was he who overthrew him and took the throne. But he was able to do something the Safavids could not. He managed to drive the Ottomans and the Russians out. He would make fairer trade agreements with the Europeans. And in the end, he would claim the title of Shah for himself. And he was blessed. Similar to how the Chinese emperors claim that they have the mandate of heaven. Well, when Nadir brought stability, the Ulyamas proclaimed that he was Mujahideen. That he was a true Islamic scholar and intellectual. In essence, he was blameless, flawless. Nadir would find the Afsharid dynasty, which in the end would rule Iran all the way up until 1979, my lifetime. And it would be based upon religion as well. So instead of competing with one another, the Shahs and the Ulyama shared power. The Shahs would control state and foreign policy. The Ulyama retained control of religion. The Shahs could make secular laws, could impose taxes. The Ulyama enforced Sharia law, which regulated people's lives. Now, by the way, this still exists today in 2024, that relationship where the secular government and the church are two parts of the same coin. Because in 1979, the Shahs, the monarchy, was overthrown, but when Ayatollah Khomeini, who is this scary-looking guy, spearheaded this revolution, the Ayatollahs, the head Ulyama, have more power in Iran than their presidents do. Because Iran calls itself a republic today. And they do have a president. But you can't become president of the republic unless the Ayatollah anoints you. But, as I said last class, because the Ayatollahs still embrace not only the fanaticism of Sufism, but also believing in the coming of the hidden Aman, That's one of the reasons why Iran is so driven to get the bomb. Because if they can blow up the world, they believe that they essentially, with Allah's divine will be the last people on earth. Because they are the true believers. And all of the unbelievers will be washed away in a flood of hellfire. Yeah. Oh, Iran is going to be fine.
So it's just the other parts of the world.
Pretty much everywhere else on Earth is going to burn, except for Iran. There's going to be this mystic barrier around them that's going to keep them safe. It's funny, when I was a kid, you know who Nostradamus is? Nostradamus, have you ever heard of Nostradamus? He was like a 16th century fortune teller. He was believed that he could see into the future. In the 1970s, they made a documentary on him called "Like the Man Who Could See Tomorrow." And they actually had a scene that talked about that the coming destruction would come from the Middle East. And it actually depicted fanatical Islamic leaders shooting nuclear weapons and basically burning the earth. But one of the sites that were hit by the nuclear weapons were the World Trade Towers. I remember seeing that as a kid. Terrified me. Oh my God, we're all going to die in nuclear winter. But the fact that Obama and then Biden are willing to give these guys pallets of money, which of course they will use to turn into a bomb, it's terrifying. It's scary stuff. Hopefully that will be your generation's problem, not mine. Actually, I can't say that because my kids are your generation. All right, we'll wait till your grandkids so that we don't have to worry about it. All right, questions? So unlike the Ottoman Empire, which we're going to come back to, I'm basically wrapping up the Safavids because they were technically done in the 18th century. I just wanted to bring it to present. All right, our last empire, our last Islamic state that we have to concern ourselves for exam number two are the Mughals. The Mughals. The Mughal Empire was an Islamic state that would, during the 16th and 17th century, penetrate the subcontinent of India and establish domination. But unlike the Ottomans, well, I suppose the Muslims, when the Ottomans took over, were a minority, but eventually they would become a majority. Unlike the Safavids, who imposed religious conformity, when the Muslims came in and conquered India, they would remain throughout their entire history a small minority population that dominated a vast, large majority of Hindus. Hindus. Any of you know anything about Hinduism? All right, well, I'm going to deviate. I'm going to another PowerPoint. I'm going to stop it here. And I'm going to switch to this one. One that I gives a little more detail to. And I'm going to bounce around on this one. There we go. The Hindu religion, as we know it, is a polytheic religion. What's polytheism? What does that refer to?
Many gods.
Many gods. All right, very good. Yes, the Hindus themselves worshipped thousands and thousands of gods. But the method, the way they worshiped, was very, very, very different. Because unlike us, who go to church, pray to God, the Arian worship was based on two forms. One involved specific sacrificial offerings, rituals. Rituals. And the other involved special hymns called Rick verses. So, in order to get a god's attention, in Hinduism, it is believed you have to give the god something. The god isn't just going to help you. The god isn't all loving, all caring, like our benevolent god if you are a Christian. But rather, the gods are like people. They're running around doing their business. Busy with their own lives, busy with their own things. So to get their help, you have to catch their attention. To catch their attention, you have to make some type of sacrifice. Typically in the form of food. So you go to a shrine and you leave for that god an offering of grain, sweet cakes, dairy products, heck, maybe even an animal, an offering. And if you can get that god's attention and you can convince that god to help you, you will actually get material gains in life, such as health, such as living a long life, such as having many offspring, or victory in war, or even a place someday up in heaven. Now the Rick verses, like I said, they're hymns. To put it in basic English, the perfect purpose of a Rick Veda is to suck up to the god. Because you say these hymns that involve prayer and adoration for the particular god. So, you want to get the god's attention? Give him a little bit of food. You want to make the god like you? Give him praise. Only if you do it right, perfectly, will the god assist you. So in comes the next important aspect of it. How do you know what to give? How do you know what to say? Well, oh, by the way, the Arians, these are the ancient Hindus. I should have mentioned that. I forgot. I cut off the who they are. All right, long story short, these have nothing to do with Nazis, but rather these are people who penetrated the Indian subcontinent in and around 1500 BC. They were invaders. They were conquerors. But they were lighter skinned than the original inhabitants of the subcontinent. And by the way, that racial division still exists in India. Lighter skinned Indians are believed to be more elevated in culture and society, whereas the darker skinned are believed to be descendants of like former subhumans, slaves. Although slavery is not allowed in modern India. But I have friends who came from India and they say, yeah, you think there's racism in America? Try living in India. You could actually be denied a job, a career, depending upon the way you look. But anyways, that's sidetrack. So the books that these ancient people left are the basis for Hinduism. And these books are where you find the knowledge on how to do the certain things. And there are three major holy books. There are the Rig Vedas. The Rig Veda is the book of knowledge. This is where you can get access to all of the Rick verses. Whoops. So, if you want to know the thousand or so ways to say just the right things to get the God's attention, you study the Rig Veda. And by the way, Hindus today still memorize the Rigs in this book. Give you a comparison, it's kind of like the Old Testament. This is like the book of the ancient stuff. There also are the Brahmanas. These are the ritual encyclopedias that tell the readers how to perform the rituals. How to properly perform the Rig verses. And in the third book of the Brahmanas, there's actually like an encyclopedia. So it actually explains the meaning. In the last book, the Upanishads, this book deals with how to achieve heavenly bliss. And how do you obtain this? Well, you have to engage in meditation. It tells you how to make the proper sacrifices. It tells you what type of ceremonies you must provide. All aimed at achieving that end goal. Happiness. Happiness in life. Questions? All right, as we said, their religion, it's polytheistic. Their gods are forces of nature. And there are hundreds and hundreds of them. There are gods, there are goddesses, there are lesser deities. And you don't have to worship any one. It's your choice. Because each of the gods has the ability to give you something. So it's very likely in your day-to-day activities, you're going to try to worship multiple gods. The god of luck, the god of health, the god of prosperity. You'll make little offerings throughout the day. Because you just don't do one thing over the course of the day. And there are four gods that were deemed key to the survival of their society. Although I should have got a comic book. See, they represent their gods in comic books. I should have gotten one for Indra, but I like the statue of him better. You got Indra right here, who is the god of storms, and he's also the patron of warriors. He, throughout most of their history, was the most popular. Because the Hindus were always going to war with somebody. So you're going to make your offering before you go on the battlefield. And you're going to pray for victory. You also have Agni. Right here, Agni. Who is the god of fire. Fire in two senses. Fire in the sense that it could bring destruction, but fire in the sense that it provides cleansing. What always happens when a forest burns down? Or whatever happens when a house burns down? What always happens? The old is removed and replaced with new. Mitra was the sun god. Obviously, we know the importance of the sun. So if you're a farmer, you'd make an offering to him. Give me just enough heat. Give me just enough so my crops will grow. And then technically, I suppose, the most important, who is regarded as the king of the gods, is Varuna, right here. Varuna. Varuna is said to be the guardians of existence. That proper balance in existence that allows for life. His job is to guarantee Day becomes day and night becomes night, only to be followed by day again. His job is to make sure there's birth, there's aging, and then there's death, and then there's renewal. In many ways, he's similar to Zeus, or Jupiter, if you prefer the Romanized version. And again, there were other gods, many other gods that the people worshipped. But these are the four most important. For example, to other gods, who would also remain important, but not as powerful as the four I mentioned, you had Vishnu. Vishnu. Vishnu is the Hindu version of Mercury, who was the god who would actually come down to Earth. In later history, Vishnu was said to have the ability to take on the form of other people. He used avatars. And basically, he would come down and he would actually help people in times of need. The most, I don't want to say powerful, we'll call him the highest god. Someone who has actually above the god, the king of gods, Brahma. Brahma is kind of like the Tien. Brahma is said to be the omnipotent essence of the universe itself, kind of like the Force in Star Wars. He himself is just detached. But you as a living being are part of him because you're part of reality, part of the cosmos. According to many one of the Hindu creation myths, it was Brahma who created the world. So being reality itself kind of explains why he's so powerful. But when you died, your loved ones, your friends, would make offerings and hope that you would have the ability to join Brahma in the afterlife. If you were lucky. But chances are you would not be. And you'd have to do it all over again. Questions? So how did you figure all this out?
Well, fortunately
for the Hindu people, they actually had wandering preachers called gurus, whose primary job it was to basically teach the people about nature and the unity of reality itself. They literally would travel around the country and preach the faith. So it was gurus, for example, that wrote the Upanishads, you know, the instructions on what you're supposed to do. It was gurus who taught about not only existence, but discussed your very soul, which they called an Atman. According to the teachings of the gurus, you are alive because you have this spirit, this indestructible spirit in you. But the spirit is what gives you life. But when you die, the Atman leaves your body and is either released to the Brahma to go back to heaven or has to do a mulligan. Has to come back, take control of another body, and do it again. Do another round of life. Any of you know of the pseudo video game that you have to play if you're a Hindu? Your existence is based upon fulfilling your obligations, your duty, your responsibilities, what the gurus call your dharma. Your dharma. Everyone in life has things we have to do. You don't have a choice. But what happens if you don't do what you're supposed to do? Or what happens when you do what you're supposed to do? Well, according to Hindu tradition, if you fulfill your duties correctly, you'll get points, like experience points, which they call karma. And you accumulate these points throughout your entire life. You get good karma, you get bad karma. This is important because when you die, your soul is judged. If you have obtained enough karma, you'll be allowed to go back and join Brahma. If, however, you don't get enough points, like I said, you gotta do it again. Because the Hindus believe in reincarnation, which they call samsara. And samsara is a circle. If your Atman does not have enough karma, you will be reborn. But the next life depends upon what you did in the previous. So, if you have more good points than bad, you will be born into a higher position in life. So maybe you were poor, desolate, homeless. Well, maybe in the next life, you will come back as someone who is a working poor. Someone who maybe can have a house, maybe can afford some food, not rich by any means, but can kind of survive. Why? Well, whatever you did in that past life was good enough to go up a notch. What happens if you're a bad person? Well, you will be demoted. So the goal is to continue to obtain better and better point scores with every subsequent reincarnation, because if you get to the top, you'll break the cycle. You'll obtain what is called enlightenment, or moksha. At this point, you're done coming back, and you're going to Brahma himself. But if you're bad, anything in existence, anything that exists in reality, could become the penalty. So according to Hindu tradition, really, really bad people come back in the form of a rock. How long does a rock exist? Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years until the rock is broken. Imagine being trapped in a rock, not being able to move, not being able to communicate, just lying on the ground. Every now and then, someone's going to pick you up and throw you in the lake. They're really good. They can skim you a couple of times. But then you would spend the next several hundred, thousands of years sitting at the bottom of the lake. You could come back in the form of an insect. You could come back in the form of an animal. This is one of the reasons why the Hindus themselves became vegetarians. Because imagine if you sat down for a nice steak, you could be eating grandma. Questions? I'm going to bounce back up. Because the other thing that I want to do is I want to talk about the social classes. Go back. Because this is also something that Muslims had to deal with. Ignore all of this. Focus on this. In Hindu society, you lived one of four classes. You were either amongst the rulers, similar to Europe. You either were a noble or you were a member of the church. In Hindu society, the Brahmins were the high priests, the people who had access to the knowledge of the gods themselves. Or you were a noble, kshatriyas. These individuals were the warriors. These were the ones that helped the rulers take control of territory. And thus, they had a special place in society. Now, similar to Europe, you're talking 5% of the society. Top 5, maybe top 6%. But once you were in these classes, you know, your family had a tendency to be there forever. Well, what if you weren't a noble? Could you still be successful? Yes, yes, you could. There was a middle class called the Vaishyas. Like the middle class in our country. These were the small farmers. These were the artisans. These were the merchants. Commoners, the folks. There also was the laboring class, like peasants. You can see, notice what happened. You have the lighter skinned individuals, then the depiction slowly start depicting darker skinned people. The Shudras generally were like peasants. They were the laborers, the serfs. They were not allowed to own land. They had to work the land. They could be laborers for the middle class or for the wealthy. But even the laborers were better off than the slaves because they also had a slave class as well. The Dasas. The Dasas were believed to be descendants of the original inhabitants that were completely subverted and conquered by the Aryans. But interestingly enough, Dasas is the word that they use for enemy as well. So, like every other civilization that has ever existed, as the Indians or the Hindus expanded their territorial domain, they conquered people and they enslaved the people and exploited them, owned them like property. Because as I mentioned when we did the transatlantic slave trade, everyone on earth has always had slaves, and slavery still exists today. Questions? Almost done, and then we'll go back to the Mughals. But here's where it gets tricky. Because the Hindus themselves further subdivided each class into a hierarchy. And each subdivision was known as a jatis. The jatis was where your family sat in society. The jatis literally were social barriers that were put in place. The moment you were born, your jatis, your family status, determined what you could do for an occupation. It determined where in society you ranked. It determined what you could eat, where you could live, Heck, it even determined marriage partners. Now, FYI, India officially outlawed the Jatis in the 1950s. But out in the countryside and in the more rural parts of India, the Jatis still exist. I've met several people who have left India, immigrated here, legally, of course, because they were fleeing the restrictions that were imposed upon them by the Jatis. And a couple of them actually came over here because they were not allowed to marry the one they loved. Their parents actually put them in an arranged marriage, and they wanted nothing to do with it. So these are archaic rules that have been in place for 2,000-3,000 years, but still exist in 2024. Questions? Well, how are these rules maintained? Well, that's where the Brahmins come in. The priests. It's the Brahmins who ultimately make the rules of the Jatis. And they enforce them. Now again, it's not as extreme today in 2024 in India as it was in, say, 1200 AD. But even today, if you violate the social laws, the rules, you could be ostracized. You could be kicked out of your family. You could be beaten. Although back in the day, you could also be executed. Because there was no individual, there's no I in team in India. Although there's an I in India. Actually, there's two. One last point. The most important thing to remember about Hindu culture is the emphasis on family. Hindus today do not think of themselves, generally speaking. They don't worry about what makes them happy. Like, we are spoiled rotten in our country. We are selfish. We are sad and self-centered. We are narcissistic. It's all about me, 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 me. Well, in India, me never comes in. It's always about family. What's good for the family? What's going to support the family? If one, and again, even with the Hindus that I've met, if there's a choice between individual gratification or self-pleasure and responsibilities to the families will always come first. Because the Hindus recognize, without the family, you would not exist. So when you go home on Friday, make sure you give mom and dad a hug. Just tell them thank you. Take out the trash. Don't be like my son. 23-year-old, I still get to yell at him. Now, the last detail I got to share, of course, was that in many ways the Hindu family was similar to the Chinese family. It was patriarchal. The eldest male was the most powerful figure in the family. Women not allowed to make decisions for themselves. Hindu women didn't have to worry about the three obediences and the four virtues, but women were expected to do whatever the males in their life told them to. Like I said, marriage wasn't based on love. Marriage was arranged. The arrangement was usually what was good for the family. Once married, the woman left her house and moved into her husband's house. And once she was there, she was considered the property of her husband's family. And lastly, like in China, the primary job of a Hindu woman, give birth to sons. Lots of sons. Dozens and dozens of sons, if possible. questions? Now, juxtapose this stuff with the stuff I told you about Islamic culture. Because ultimately, that's what the Mughals faced when they came in and would seize control. I didn't realize I had that much details. Oh, well, whatever. I liked what I was able to do better. No, we're not going that way. Help, I can't see. There's a glare. Help me. Oh, back. What am I doing? All right, we'll do it this way. Technical difficulties. Ignore. There we go. All right. Now, I should also say that when the Mughals appeared, they actually were not the first Muslims in India. Islam appeared as early as the 8th century. We're talking the 700s. But initially, they came as explorers. But by the 10th century, armies were forming. And the Muslim rulers in Afghanistan would actually attempt to penetrate the subcontinent 11 times. But by the 12th century, they managed to penetrate. And by the 13th century, they managed to conquer a good chunk of the subcontinent. They didn't control it all, but they controlled a good chunk of it. The seat of power was in the city of Delhi. It was in Delhi that they would establish a sultanate. A governmental system similar to what the Ottomans had in place, where the leader was expected to not only be the chief war leader, but also was in charge of spreading the faith. Now, I'm not going to get into it, but control over Delhi changed. In the span of 300 years, there were 5 different dynasties, Muslim dynasties, that would rise up, seize control, impose their will, only to be toppled by another group that would seize control. So it was very complex. We're not going to worry about that. But instead, we'll fast forward into the 16th century when the next group of invaders would be the Mughals. Now, the Mughals were a mixed race and culture. They were descendants of Mongolians who married into native populations. So as a result, they were simultaneously Middle Eastern as well as Asian. But they definitely retained the warrior skills of their ancestors. So they primarily attacked on horseback. They were very effective warriors from the seat of a horse. They were good with archery. Although the Mughals were also one of the first Eastern peoples to adopt the firearm, to largely embrace guns, which ultimately allowed them to seize control. Now, their first great conqueror, who would march into India and seize control of Delhi, was Barbour. Barbour claimed to be a descendant of not only Genghis Khan, but also Timur, who I mentioned in passing. Timur was that guy who invaded the Ottoman territory during the reign of Bazayed. Barbour actually took the throne when his father died at 12 and swiftly beat even his older relatives into place. He was a tough, badass kid. Well, in 1504, word got to Barbour because his reputation spread beyond his homeland. And they were just on the other side of the Khybar Pass. Word about his abilities, his benevolence, his skill. So in 1504, he was actually invited by a bunch of Hindu priests and princes who wanted to get rid of the Sultan in Delhi. So he entered India as a liberator. And within his lifetime, he managed to conquer much of northern India. Just to go back real quick, I have it here. This is the area that he would take control of. By the time he died in 1530, a good slice, a nice sized kingdom. Okay, so what, Lamanic? You've talked about dozens of these guys that came in and conquered. What makes him special? Well, here you go. What makes Barbour unique was, unlike, say, Shah Ismail, who was a religious bigot, Barbour was broad-minded. Broad-minded. He understood the importance of his faith, but within days, months, weeks, years, not necessarily in that order, of taking control of India, he learned about the religion of the people that he now is ruling over. And in his rule, he made sure the laws were not offensive to the Hindu faith. So, for example, in the city of Delhi, he made it illegal for Muslims to kill cows. Now, Muslims can eat beef. Muslims can eat chicken. Just can't, it's not supposed to eat pork. For hundreds of years, the Muslims in Delhi openly slaughtered cows, which the Hindus believed to be a sacred animal. Well, one of the first laws he imposed was he said the Muslims could no longer slaughter beef or cows in the capital. They would be allowed to get beef, but they had to raise the beef out in the countryside, and they had to slaughter it in isolation. And they were only allowed to use cows that they imported from Islamic lands. They couldn't use native cows, because the native cows could have the souls of the loved ones of the Hindus. He also told his soldiers not to loot, not to rape, not to pillage. When you consider what Genghis Khan allowed his men to do, or what Timur allowed his men to do, or heck, even what the Ottomans allowed, what Mohammed allowed his soldiers to rape and pillage Constantinople for 3 days. Well, from the get-go, any soldier that attacked, assaulted a Hindu would be killed on sight by the emperor himself. And he, in creating his empire, would attempt to implement a civilization based on an idea that would not exist in Europe until the 1700s. The notion of toleration. He did not force Islam upon his subjects. In fact, he allowed the Hindus to freely worship. Now, by the way, as I mentioned when I was talking about Islam before, the Quran specifically dictates that pagans, i.e. polytheists, need to be destroyed. It's the will of Allah. But here you have a Muslim basically saying, live and let live. Hindus could build temples. Hindus could have their holy days. They could freely worship. But at the same time, trade was encouraged. So he would allow Muslim merchants to come from abroad into his kingdom and bring the goods via the Asian trade network. He also would make peace. Peace with the kingdoms in the south. By the end of his reign, he basically declared, this is my empire and that's enough. He decided to end war, which was shocking. Thus, is one of the reasons why he's regarded as one of the most significant founders of any kingdom on earth. Unfortunately, his son wasn't so good, and I just got a little bit on his son, and then we'll come back with his grandson on Thursday. Actually, you know what? I'll save Humayun for next class. Questions? All right, for those of you who came late, I want to reiterate something I said on Thursday. You're going to have your second exam, which technically will be your midterm exam. I am going to open it up for you guys on Thursday. You'll have until Sunday to get it done. Now, I have to submit midterm grades. I'm supposed to do it on Friday, but I will lollygag and I will submit them on Monday. So the key is you all have to make sure you get the exam in as quickly as possible. So if you're able to knock it out on Thursday, great. I would be greatly appreciative. The other thing is, just like with the time frame of the exam, I will also give you till Sunday if you're doing the two chapter review questions and definitions that are that coincide with what we covered in class. But that extra credit must come in by, say, like midnight on Sunday, or we'll say 11:59 on Sunday night. So that way I can wake up on Monday and I can grade it, I can add it in, and then upload your current average. One last thing, your midterm grade, keep in mind, it's not half of the class. Your midterm grade will only count as 30%. First exam is worth 15%, second exam is worth 15%. So if you didn't do so great on the first exam, now is good time to work a little harder and try to do a little bit better. If you can get your average slowly going up, that's the path you want to be on. But don't do one of these. Oh, exam one was easy, so I'm not going to do anything, and then bomb the second. You want upward trajectory, not down. Or you could be like a week up and just get A's on everything. So, but he's an all-star. He always will be in my book. Questions? All right, we'll see you all on Thursday.